and it doesn't even make sense to say, okay, you know, kick out Trump. There's no mechanism for it either, like there is in a multi-party system, more than two parties. The duopoly here is you're going to get the same policies from a Republican as you are from a Democrat on these huge, you know, tragedies. And there's no clear alternative being put forward. So even if you had the mechanism, you'd wonder, I wonder, with just a duopoly, it wouldn't mean much. A political duopoly, meaning Democrat, Republican, Republican, Democrat. How could this have been avoided? In this article, clearly not enough was done. Oh, by the way, quick legal identification. We're WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO Medford. You're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And we are Socialist Alternative Radio from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. We have another hour to go. We are talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. And we're here every other week with this programming. And we, if you're new to listening, check us out on Facebook. Or if you're not new, either way, go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Give us some feedback. Tell us about some things, whatever. We've been on the air here for over 10 years, and we like it. It's good to get out some information, even in a minimal way, that you're just not going to hear anywhere else. And that includes the idea, the organizing idea of, hey, yeah, become an activist, but not just an activist, not just a single issue person or whatever. Get involved with the fight for socialism that touches every issue, that gets to the heart of the matter, which is capitalism. And that includes these so-called natural disasters. They're made very unnatural, unfortunately, by capitalism. And right now we're talking about the effects of lack of the way cities are planned, the effects of not being able to evacuate, that's given as the only answer, the effects of inadequate compensation when these things happen, and so on. Now we'll get into that a little more. How could this have been avoided? Clearly not enough was done to prepare for a hurricane despite the stark warnings of climate scientists. This is about Houston again, but we could apply it to Florida. The lack of regulations on pollution and carbon emissions demanded by fossil fuel and automobile companies is the driving force behind the breakdown of our climate. Although climate change did not necessarily cause this specific hurricane, it created warmer oceans and a warmer planet, leading to more water vapor in the air and more intense rainfall. So climate change does cause more powerful hurricanes. Now, what I've heard about this, I'm not quoting now, what I've heard about this is that this is the most powerful hurricane ever, the one that's hitting Florida right now, et cetera. So there's more in that in the article, very good stuff about the corporations and their link to the lack of planning, proper planning and compensation and so on. Let me just go into a little bit of that. Another key factor was the way establishment politicians in Houston, this is again about the Hurricane Harvey, from both Republican and Democratic parties enabled and encouraged a mass amount of unregulated economic development in recent decades. Houston's total lack of zoning and its developer-friendly policies allowed huge parts of prairie lands to be paved over with concrete, leaving nowhere for rain to go but inside people's homes. And that actually got out in the corporate media a little bit, but like a lot of other things that managed to work their way, a little bit of truth managed to work their way in the blanket of lies, that basically it will be forgotten pretty quickly, unfortunately, unless people that are struggling on these issues keep it alive. Then the article ends, the alternative to chaos caused by capitalism and the greed of billionaires is socialism, democratic planning to replace the profit-driven anarchy of the market system. We need to build the socialist and workers' movement around the central demand of taking the top 500 corporations into public ownership under the democratic management of working people. This would lay the basis for establishing a rational, democratically planned society based on meeting the needs of people and the planet, not profits. So I thought that was a very good article. Unfortunately, you're not going to hear in the corporate media that capitalism is the cause of the unnecessary suffering people are facing due to these hurricanes. Now, in the past, there's also been comparisons on a more superficial level of, say, Cuba, which is, we don't consider a socialist country, but it does have elements of a plan, still involved, you know, kind of a sort of Stalinist bureaucratic plan, but still a plan of production for the most part versus the anarchy of the market. And Cuba has often survived these, the people in Cuba have often survived these hurricanes, and they're right in the path of a lot of them, much better than the capitalist countries, even though Cuba is a small island, right? And I'm not sure that was the case this time, but I think it was. And we need to look into that more as well. And they don't talk about aid to Cuba, by the way. In fact, Cuba and Venezuela and other countries that are roundly denounced by the Trump administration, but of course also just any U.S. government administration and the corporations, there is aid coming in from Venezuela and Cuba, I've heard. So let's talk about DACA really quickly. The corporate media did actually cover this to a great extent, but it always was kind of this coverage of wanting, not having any solutions, number one, but also, when they interviewed people, that were kind of, they wanted like basically sob stories, and they wanted immigrants to say that they're useful for the economy and useful to the United States, and sort of economic exploitation argument. Yeah, we love to be exploited. Exploit us some more, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what's going on with immigrants in general that you'll never hear or hardly ever hear in the corporate media is it's just a clear look. Every country in the world has immigrants, just about, because immigrants are migrant workers and their families, maybe people that can't work, they're too young or too old, but whatever. It's basically migrant workers, right? Now, under capitalism sets the situation that forces migration of workers to go where they can sell their labor, or go where they can sell their labor for a lot more, to subsidize where they can't sell their labor for enough in poorer countries. But poor countries are not just a force of nature. They're not some sort of like thing that just appeared. If you read about the history of capitalism, and I especially urge you to read about Leon Trotsky's work, The Permanent Revolution, but it appeared in other places as well, the parts about combined and uneven development of capitalism and what that's meant politically and economically throughout the world. It's not like the first capitalist countries came into being, with all the blood and gore of slavery and feudalism, and some of them still using slavery and genocide over native peoples and so on. Not like they came into their power, right, and all the money they accumulated, what Marx calls the primitive accumulation of capitalism, of capital under capitalism. It's not like they then said, okay, we're gonna now increase our colonial empire. We're gonna do more invasion of other countries now as capitalists. But we're going to do it really differently. We're not going to, we're going to invite them, these countries that we go to exploit more or to exploit for the first time or whatever, under capitalism, we're going to invite them into the boardrooms and into our governments, and they're going to be equal partners in this wonderful adventure of the exploitation of labor and nature for profit, which is capitalism. And no, of course not. That's absurd. That's a fairy tale. Capitalism is part and parcel. It's totally grown through combined and uneven development. Meaning, yeah, United States, Britain, France, other massively wealthy in terms of GDP, not in terms of how everyone's living, but in terms of GDP and so on. These countries got that way through exploiting the labor and the natural resources of poorer countries, and then selling stuff back in many cases to those countries by controlling terms of trade, by controlling trade routes, and so on. Combined, I don't even know. They did not invite the weaker countries or the non-capitalist countries to be part of this wonderful experiment that's raising all boats somehow. No. They dominated, and they still do. And there are exceptions based on things that happen, like the Scandinavian countries were very weak economically, but the post-war until the post-war upswing, the place they found themselves in between in the Cold War between the United States and Russia, not being devastated by World War II as other countries. So then you had the Scandinavian countries gaining market share beyond their size and so on, beyond their weight. You have little countries like maybe Singapore that became a banking center, or you have uh, You have China, which was a Stalinist country that basically at a certain point within the last 20 years, they turned over more and more of their infrastructure they had created in a non-capitalist way. They turned over more and more of their infrastructure to capitalism. So they have a form of state capitalism now. So there are exceptions to this relentless keeping down of most of the world through commodity development. But the general trend is keeping down the poor countries from the start to the finish, whatever that may be, under capitalism, and not allowing them. You hear a lot about development, right? Well, you have different definitions. Development for an advanced capitalist country, quote unquote, advanced meaning just richer in terms of GDP and so on, gross domestic product. Their idea of development is to go in and exploit the crap out of a country. They're going to invest and own the profits taken out of that country. Look at Nigeria, for example. Rich oil wealth in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country. The most people in any one country in Africa are in Nigeria. And it's got enormous natural wealth. But most Nigerians are dirt poor. And this is because the big capitalist countries have for decades, over a century, gone in there. And especially when they hit on the oil deposits, they just take that oil out of there and they sell it for profit, And Nigeria, except for some like obvious graft to the ruling class, to the indigenous capitalist class there. Now, by indigenous, I don't mean from the start, but the one that was cultivated by imperialism, by the big capitalist powers, economically, militarily. They get some trickle down, but the vast majority of the country gets nothing, even though it's extremely wealthy in terms of natural resources. This is repeated in many, many, many countries around the world, of course. And it's part of the combined and uneven development of capitalism. And this forces, by its very nature, migratory patterns of workers. If you don't choose where you're born. You get born somewhere, even within a rich country like the United States. Say I was born in Appalachia or something, and the factory that used to be there, the coal mine that used to be there, is not operating. I gotta move, right? Most likely. Say I was born into a farm somewhere back when decades ago, when there were more farmers, and then the big agricultural companies continued their monopolization of agriculture in this country. The farm had to sell the farm, couldn't make it. The bank took the farm and it got evicted, got to move, So within countries, people are moving, but also outside of countries, people are forced to move. NAFTA increased migration from Mexico to the United States by tons and tons. I don't have the figures in front of me, but by millions and millions of workers, because it destroyed a lot of Mexican agriculture and destroyed a lot of manufacturing. Now, they talk about, manufacturing was then brought in. There was some manufacturing brought to the border area. It still is there, some of it. But that's limited in terms of what the amount of jobs it can provide, quote-unquote, amount of jobs it will exploit, the amount of labor it will exploit, compared to the amount of jobs that were destroyed throughout Mexico and other countries as well. So it's under capitalism, there's no plan of production based on where people live and what people want. There is a plan of production based on what the capitalists feel is most profitable for them at a given moment. The short-term maximization of profit is their god, and if that means setting up a manufacturing thing or a distribution thing somewhere, plant or, workplace somewhere that's completely inconvenient for people, or smack down in the middle of a city where there's no decent housing for working people and so on, they'll do it for their reasons. They don't do it for the comfort of the working class or the needs of the working class. And this creates, so, for example, where in the United States, the monopolization of agriculture creates a need for cheap labor. The big farms, and they don't want to pay a living wage or even close to it. there's a shortage, quote unquote, of workers. Not only will that forced migration from say Mexico or some other country, but it would be encouraged at times. You know, in the United States, immigration is encouraged. There was no rules against it at certain times in the United States, or very few rules against it, and it was very, very much encouraged. And now, and it's always this really confusing issue for the ruling class in a way. But I don't mean that they're confused about it. I mean that the signals they send are confusing, because they, on the one hand, want to exploit immigrant labor, the extra threat of deportation, of not having certain rights as a citizen, strengthens the hand of the bosses, unless there's a strong labor movement to counteract that. And right now, labor movement is on the defensive for the most part. So a lot of them love immigration, but a lot of them love to attack immigration too, because it keeps the immigrants on the ropes. It keeps them as a compliant workforce. The attacks keep them, as non-citizens and able to use that more. And there are some corporations that don't use much immigrant labor, so they're just, you know, feed into that kind of racist, right-wing, populist political strategy that Trump used, for example, to make gains politically, to make gains against their competitor capitalists that might be dependent on that labor or whatever. But capitalism in so many ways, in ways I don't have time to go into, generates migration. And you can't blame workers for that. People have to survive. You can't blame workers working, by the way, by extension. This is another thing I hate about liberal environmentalists. You can't blame workers for working in a polluting industry or something. You got to go where you can sell your labor. And you have very little choice in the matter, believe it or not. You know, it might seem like, oh, everyone, you know, there's jobs out there. Go get a job. You can get a job. And just choose to work where you want to work and so on. Well, I'm constrained by what I can do, what my so-called skills are, what I know. Was I able to afford to go to college or not? Do I abandon my family? Can I do that? Do I abandon any kind of living situation that I'm surviving in, but if I move, it will be gone and I'll have to start from scratch? Does the job, those many, many jobs you're talking about out there, do they pay enough for me to live on, et cetera, et cetera? So, getting another job. Well, so that also shows you, by the way, how really serious it is to migrate, right? To migrate, to take that risk, to go somewhere else. And, the just personal safety risks, but the risks to your livelihood and being able to survive economically is huge. It's really huge. The other point that I made earlier, which is really frustrating, even when DACA gets a lot of attention, as well it should, and Trump should, of course, Trump and whoever else is behind him should not have gone along with this, should not have attacked this. This is like DACA is this little reform that helps, important reform that helps mainly youth whose parents are undocumented or whatever, they came in undocumented, and this is a way to get documented, to get papers and so on. And a lot of people that signed up for it obviously thought this gave them more of a rooted nature in this country, and they could go on and try to survive with a little more, a little less stress, a little more stability. And of course, that's now all thrown up in the air, and it's really, really horrible and unnecessary and wrong. And the number of people affected is not even a number that will, the whole idea of immigrants taking jobs and so on just breaks down mathematically so easily that it's not really the case. There's definitely situations where employers, bosses, like to hire mostly or solely immigrant labor to exploit the crap out of immigrants with that threat of deportation hanging over their heads and so on. But that's what the corporations do. That's not the immigrants' fault. It's not our fault as workers. And they should go after the corporations for hiring immigrant workers, but only if there's, you know, situations, set up retraining and so on, so the immigrant workers can survive and get another job. I mean, basically, there's no, even a lot of the immigrant workers or people that spoke for them in some of these corporate media, or all the ones I heard, all these corporate media things, there was never any solutions put forward, really, except defend DACA, which we agree with. Yes, bring back DACA. But there's other things you have to say concretely, and I want to point to a statement by Shama Sawant. Now, Shama Sawant, that's spelled K-S-H-A-M-A, last name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. Shama is a member of Social Alternative who was elected, and they often forget to mention re-elected, with even a greater voter share. She was elected in 2013, re-elected in 2016, I believe it was, to Seattle City Council. And she'll be in City Council until her term will be up in 2019. Now, Shama, is a member of Social Alternative, ran as an open socialist member of Social Alternative. And as we've said on the show before, we've been able to help organize and lead many significant struggles in Seattle. The one that got the most publicity, which is very, very important, is Seattle was the first city with a $15 minimum wage. That was largely a result of Shama Sawant, Social Alternative, leading that struggle. And the 15 minimum wage law was the first in the nation for a big city. And it continues to, help, obviously, bring up wages in Seattle for tens of thousands of workers. And big, big victory. There have been others that got less attention that were, not as impactful in the immediate sense, but there have been other victories, and some very impactful, some that very made a big difference in housing issues and so on. So Shama has a certain profile, Social Alternative has a certain profile that, will get a certain amount of attention, will get a certain amount of interviews and so on. And this was so part of organizing from a position of city council is to use that as a platform to put forward alternative ideas and strategies and tactics to what the corporate media is putting forward for the capitalists. So she has a blog, a city council blog, that I really urge people to check out, Shama Sawant's, from her city council blog. And there's this thing, hashtag resist Trump documents and leaflets and statements. So this comes out, it's a statement made on September 7th by Shama Sawant regarding Trump's attacks on DACA. And I'm just going to quote it here. It's very short, quote a bit of it. Donald Trump's egregious attack on the lives of over 800,000 Deferred Action for Children arrivals DACA recipients is part of his promised all-out right-wing assault on immigrants. As an immigrant myself, and again, I'm quoting Shama Sawant here, as an immigrant myself, as a member of the labor movement, and as an elected socialist and working people's representative, I stand in solidarity with all our immigrant community members, students, workers, and families. I have been repeatedly inspired by the courage and determination of the many immigrant community members who have taken real risks to assert their rights. Our movement needs to act swiftly in a united manner to defend this attack, just like we did when we organized peaceful mass demonstrations by the thousands, including an airport shutdown, which were decisive at the time in blocking Trump's first Muslim travel ban. This attack on DACA recipients is an attempt by Trump to further advance his far-right, billionaire-backed agenda and to use immigrants as fodder in a desperate divide-and-conquer tactic to distract from the crisis of his administration. Many of our friends, family, and allies today are understandably fearful about a future without DACA, and apprehensive of even more far-reaching attacks on their families and coworkers. But DACA recipients are far from powerless because, in solidarity with other workers, we can build a powerful immigrant rights movement with massive protests and nonviolent civil disobedience. In light of the recent events in Charlottesville, we need to unite our movements for immigrant rights and against racism. Trump's agenda, putting profits before people and the environment, is about tax cuts for big business and the rich, stoking military aggression abroad, and attacking unions and workers' rights at home. But he and the right wing will only succeed if we are divided. An injury to one is an injury to all. And it is critical that we in the labor movement work alongside immigrant rights activists to organize mass public protests and workplace actions to defeat this attack and drive out Trump. Our movement demands hands-off DACA. Not one more deportation. Free those currently in detention. No ban, no wall, no raids. Now, when I'm going through these demands, because this is something that I felt really, really, really lacked any interview I heard, and even some of the speeches I've heard at rallies and heard about from rallies and so on, there's the real lack of where to go, how to go forward here, other than, reestablish DACA. It's not enough. But yes, of course, we used to talk, but it's not enough. So hands off DACA, not one more deportation. Free those currently in detention. That's very, very important. No ban, no wall, no raids. Shut down private prisons used by ICE, including the Northwest Detention Center. Again, Shama speaking from Seattle here. Make Washington a sanctuary state. Remove federal surveillance cameras from Seattle and end video feeds to fusion centers. So that must be, I don't know much about that. Must be a more high-tech way of for ICE to capture more people. Make Seattle a real sanctuary city with all work that all work people can afford to live in. We need rent control and affordable housing. Notice the connection to that, because that's very, very true. A stronger community with a more less precarious living standards and so on, lifestyle and living standards and so on, will really help the movement. Full civil rights and legalization for all. That last point is very important. Apparently people are afraid to say this a lot of the time, and they should not be. We do need full civil rights and legalization for all. And, that, and one way to translate that is immediate unconditional legalization and equal rights for all undocumented immigrants. This is from page 2 of what we stand for in the Socialist Alternative paper. And that's, yes, we do need that, very much so. We need, which is often referred to as amnesty, you know. And then what do you do next, you know, after that, when the next wave of immigrants comes, forced to come here, to chase money, to chase the big capitalist vacuum that is the United States, it's the richest country in the world and so on. So if there's a way to get here to make more money than you can in countries where the United States and other capitalist powers have created a condition of perpetual poverty, and you come here and you try, and by the way, it doesn't work for a lot of people, obviously, but you try to make more money, send some back to people that are still back in the country you came from, etc. What happens when that kicks up again? Well, we say we have the same demands, basically. We keep working to organize for socialism. We keep working to organize for stronger unions and so on, all with migrant workers, of course. They are brothers and sisters, you know. There's no difference. There's no difference between workers. This is one of the ABCs of basic socialism. No difference between workers on account of nationality, right? We don't choose where we're born. So the workers' movement, in its most progressive socialist, communist, whatever phases, is always trying for maximum unity among the working class. And maximum unity through whatever the right word is, attempts to divide us on nationality, on race, on gender, etc. We're for working class unity to the maximum we can build that. An injury to one is an injury to all, right? And that's true that if you want to pose the question of solving immigration under capitalism, it will never be solved under capitalism. That's absolutely impossible. We can fight for these very progressive demands that will ameliorate, temporarily at least, maybe a little bit longer, the conditions of a lot of immigrants through, you know, full civil rights, legalization for all. Yes, multiple times if necessary. Then the question comes up from the left, well, why don't you just be for open borders and be done with it? Well, yeah, okay, open borders are great, but that's like a empty assertion. We're not formally, officially for open borders right now under capitalism, because capitalism is based on the nation state and based on, that's never going to happen under capitalism, you know? Even in the EU, look at what's happened with that. So, open borders is a goal, but under capitalism, it's not, at this point, realizable and can be used as a trigger sort of thing by the capitalists to say, oh, they just want chaos or something. They're not realistic or whatever. I look forward to the time where open borders is included in basic demands, but you have to organize for that. You have to get up to that point. Consciousness is not always at that point. I think there is, even with legalization for all, with amnesty, that is in consciousness even more than just like, oh, open up the borders under capitalism and let the chips fly where they may, you know. We're not for closed borders. We're not for increased repression at the borders. But to use the term open borders at this point in time is counterproductive, unfortunately, based on where consciousness is at, based on the capitalists, the way they are controlling, migratory patterns, or trying to. And we can fight that. We can undermine that to a great extent in favor of, you know, decent life for everyone, you know, unity of the working class as much as possible, and really trying for basically the beginnings of democratic socialism. But that's not always the same demands come out always at the same time. You don't always have the same demands in order to achieve that or to make the biggest gains that you can make from these different struggles, biggest immediate gains that you can make. I think under a socialist society, we would have open borders, obviously. But it's not in the consciousness yet in any great way under capitalism, and unfortunately. But even under capitalism, it could be at a certain point, but that's going to take a lot more organizing. Now, Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International. And the Committee for Workers International is an international socialist grouping in over 40 countries. Now, if internationalism grows, as we're trying to make it grow, and if it grows in an organized way with mass political parties being developed, and that hasn't happened yet. See, the Committee for Workers International is hopefully the beginning or part of the beginning of something like that. But if in the future and near future, hopefully, mass parties come out of that, then basically, at an international scale, then basically you'll have more organizing power to start to shift demands in a more radical way. That space doesn't yet exist in terms of where people are at with their consciousness and so on. By the way, we do have a duty here with our shows to do public service announcements. So I'm going to take a quick break from the discussion we're having, this points we're making about immigrant rights, to these kind of random public service announcements. I'm just picking them out of a book here. Know your cell phone rights. Public service announcement. Whether you're taking your cell phone with you on a walk, in your car, or to a civil protest, you should know your legal rights. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that police must obtain a warrant to search a person's cell phone. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled, I'm repeating that police must obtain a warrant to search a person's cell phone. However, a phone without a passcode can readily be searched by anybody holding it. And a Virginia court recently ruled that a defendant can be compelled to unlock a device that's protected only by a fingerprint sensor. So consider using a keyboard, key code, password, and setting your phone screen to lock very quickly when no one is using it, particularly if you expect to be in a potentially volatile situation. When the police can't legally force you to unlock your phone, they can ask you, while the police can't legally force you to unlock your phone, they can ask you to, and if you do that, you forfeited your rights. They can ask you to unlock your phone. If you do that, you forfeited your rights. The correct answer to a cop's request to search you, your vehicle, or your phone is, quote, "No, officer, I do not consent to a search. Thank you," end quote. Finally, remember that the police can always ask a judge for a search warrant, so think carefully about what's stored on your phone, including photos, contacts, and app data. You can learn more about your rights from the Electronic Freedom Foundation on the web at EFF.org. And this is a public service message from the EFF and your freedom-loving friends here at WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And I really like that PSA, that public service announcement. Let's go one more with one that's, because of the hurricanes and so on, should resonate here. Emergency preparedness public service announcement. Unexpected situations such as a power outage, water disruption, or other emergency can happen at any time. So be prepared by having a couple of gallons of drinking water and a supply of food stored in your home. Now, I'm just going to go off the script here for a second. They don't tell you what kind of food to stay in your home, to store in your home, but obviously it's the kind that could exist without refrigeration and could be easily opened and consumed. Now, quoting back from this PSA, it's also an excellent idea to keep a few flashlights and other non-flammable light sources handy. Candles and other open flames can be very dangerous. And the worst possible time to cause a fire is when there is some other emergency going on. That's a very wise public service message from ready.gov and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. There you go, public service announcements. Now, we do have a new issue of the Socialist Alternative newspaper. Go to socialalternative.org for information on how to get a copy, how to subscribe and so on, who to get in touch with to get a copy personally delivered if necessary. And we, it's a very good issue. It's geared towards, the students to a little extent because of the new year starting and so on in colleges and high schools. There's a very interesting Why I'm a Socialist by Jay Chavez. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. I know Jai. I said Jay. I'm sorry. I meant Jai. Jai Chavez. Jai Chavez is the correct pronunciation, I believe. He's a student in Worcester, Mass. joined Social Alternative as a high school student, now going to college and still in Social Alternative. And he did a really brilliant feature, a regular feature of this newspaper, Why I'm a Socialist. And I'm not going to read it because I wanted him to read it on the air one of these days. I'll have him call in or maybe show up to the show. And I think it's really good. You'll see that in this new issue. You'll see a little bit about something that's happening that's already happened this weekend or happening still. Town hall draft Bernie for a People's Party. And this is a effort that Social Alternative has helped out with, along with the Progressive Independent Party and others, to have Sanders launch a People's Party, break with the Democrats and launch a People's Party. And there's this draft Bernie thing. There's been 50,000 online signatures created, over 50,000. They've been submitted to Sanders. He's been invited to attend. I don't think he did attend, as far as I know. It was still going on last night. I was watching YouTube live of the thing. And just a quote here from an article by Calvin Priest on this town hall draft Bernie for a People's Party event. Quote, the Democratic establishment remains fiercely determined to defend its close ties to big business. In spite of massive support for single-payer health care, the Democrats' better deal, quote-unquote, for the coming elections has kept this and other central issues off the table. Pelosi, Schumer, and company prefer to risk further losses to the right wing rather than accepting progressive policies that would endanger their corporate support. Let's see. Taking over the Democratic Party, quote, highly unlikely to succeed. I wouldn't even qualify it. It will not succeed. But anyway, it is time for working people and activists to begin a serious discussion about a new major party, drop a ballot sheet of recent efforts to explore what a People's Party would look like, and talk about strategies for our movement and what will be needed to defeat Trump and the right wing. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. You can look on YouTube for that. Again, the draft Bernie for a People's Party on YouTube. Look for more material in socialistalternative.org on that in the near future. And yeah, I saw some of the videos, I saw Shama speaking and so on. And you might want to check that out on YouTube. This issue of the newspaper continues with a big article about the Trump administration and how to fight the right. But also something I really wanted to get into that was alluded to earlier in the show. We've launched a campaign called Affordable Seattle in Seattle, where Shama Sawant is a Social Alternative member on city council. Quote, demanding rent control, socialists launch, quote, Affordable Seattle. Independent candidates strong showing in the primaries. That's because there's an election thing happening for mayor and other races that are up for grabs in Seattle. Not Shama Sawant's seat, by the way. Let's see. And by the way, two candidates that Social Alternative supported who were independents. One of them looks like they made it through to the general election. John Grant, nominally a Democratic Socialist, says he is. We support his campaign. And Nikita Oliver, who did not make it to the second round, so to speak, or the basic round now. And she came in third. Now, 2 days previously, when this article was written, I don't know, actually the date is a little unclear. Anyway, more than 250 local residents packed Seattle's Washington Hall to mark the official launch of Affordable Seattle. Campaign volunteers already put in over 1,000 hours of door knocking in support of Grant and Oliver over the previous 6 weeks. Social Alternative and City Council member Shawan Swan initiated Affordable Seattle. Working people in Seattle are currently facing a crisis of affordability. That's going to sound familiar, obviously, to Boston, a lot of other places. Rents have risen 57% in the past 6 years. And housing has gotten so expensive that a person working minimum wage would have to work 87 hours per week to afford a one-bedroom apartment. Yes. Working class communities across the city, especially communities that are home to people of color, like the city's historically black central district, are seeing their residents forced to move out as for-profit developers invest millions of dollars into gentrifying neighborhoods and raising rents. So it's really bad. Obviously, the city in a boom. I'm not quoting here. I'm just riffing for a second. A city in a boom on a superficial level, but you get down to the fact of living there, and there's huge problems with rents and so on. So, quote, affordable housing Affordable Seattle is bringing bringing working people from across Seattle together to organize and fight around three bold demands. One, vast expansion of the city's publicly owned affordable housing funded by a tax on big business. That's something we're getting into earlier in the show. Two, requiring a full 25% of new private housing will be built in the city to be affordable, and organizing a movement to overturn the ban on rent control. Three, making landlords pay for economic evictions. So during June and July, volunteers with Affordable Seattle knocked on thousands of doors across central and south Seattle and spoke to tenants at risk of displacement, getting thousands of petition signatures supporting the three demands. Let's see. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but Socialist Alternative and Affordable Seattle continue to campaign for investment in affordable housing, rent control, and relocation assistance, building on the success of the Shama Sawant in demonstrating the viability of candidates to shun the Democratic Party machine and run as independents. John Grant's campaign will be a crucial part of this fight. He's still running. He's one of the people running for city council that we endorsed. Good article by Adam Ziemkowski on how Seattle voted to tax the rich. Also in this paper, that's another thing that happened. Now there was a tax the rich thing. Now this was interesting. Moved first by Shama and another city council member, and then eventually embraced by the entire city council, which is really hilarious because you know they didn't like it, but they just saw the steamroller coming at them, basically. And the detail is it is passed as a law, but there's also a law in Washington State saying you can't raise taxes at the municipal level, so there'll be a legal fight over this and an organizational fight as well, I would hope, or organizational fighting for it. But basically, a little bit from this article, how Seattle voted to tax the rich. Seattle further cemented its reputation as one of the most progressive cities in the U.S. last week when the... This was more than a week ago, by the way, so this article is a little older than that. It was... when did it pass? I think about 2 months ago, but I have to double-check. Maybe more than that, actually. So anyway, passed a law to tax the rich, sponsored by Social City Council member Shama Sawant, along with Council member Lisa Arbold. The law places a 2.25% tax on individual incomes over $250,000 and $500,000 for married couples. It's expected to raise as much as $175 million to fund affordable housing, education, transit, human services, and other critical needs. Recognizing the significance of Seattle's new tax on the rich, the Los Angeles Times reported, quote, a number of cities have adopted local income taxes, but no other city has solely targeted high-wage earners, and few have adopted so high a tax rate. This measure has opened the door to political warfare in the state. So obviously they're afraid, but obviously we refute the idea that no city is slowly targeted high wage earners, that this is a high tax rate we're proposing, and that yes, it will lead to political warfare because the capitalists don't give up anything without a fight. So again, the law places a 2.25% tax on individual incomes over $250,000 and $500,000 for married couples. Now, if you actually read the data on how much people make in this country, it's pretty shocking. It's a lot less than you think, and very, very, very few people are making as much money as I just quoted. Very, very few people are making incomes over $250,000 or $500,000, even combined with their spouses or whatever. In Seattle, I'm quoting from the article again, the end of it, the tax the rich fight is far from over. The right-wing Freedom Foundation has already filed a lawsuit saying the tax violates a Washington state law barring cities from taxing net income. The courts are subject to the power and pressures of social movements, as has been shown over and over in U.S. history, and recently with the victory on marriage equality in the Supreme Court. Without a doubt, our movement in Seattle is ready to take our fight into the courthouses as well as back into the streets. Now, very quickly, because we're running out of time, I want to point on the listeners to the Ginger Jensen campaign out of Minneapolis. This is also a member of Socialist Alternative running as an open socialist and openly as a member of Socialist Alternative. Again, Ginger Jensen. Now, what Ginger has become known for out there is she was the leader of the director of 15, executive director of 15 Now. That means $15 minimum wage now. And that actually passed after a lot of struggle. I've told the story on the air. I don't have time to tell it now. At the end of July, Minneapolis became the first Midwestern city to enact a $15 minimum wage. The proposal will benefit 71,000 workers, overwhelmingly women and workers of color. Winning 15 in Minneapolis shows another way cities can push back against Trump's corporate-backed agenda. The mayor of Minneapolis and most in city council resisted 15 up until a constant movement from below forced them to act. Where city councilors stood on the 15 million wage alongside other demands. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that. It gets into the kind of other politics within the city, but basically the thing to know is Ginger Jensen, independent socialist, member of Social Alternative, running in Ward 3 of Minneapolis for city council. She's escalated the pressure for 15 inside City Hall. Even as the campaign got going, now she's offering voters a taste of what a socialist organizer elected to City Hall would accomplish. Much like Shama Sawant's successful socialist campaigns for Seattle City Council, the Jensen campaign is having a citywide impact by acting as a party to amplify working class concerns. So this is a campaign I'd urge you to look more into and go to, www.gingerjensen.org for more information, including how to donate to the campaign and so on. And speaking of donations, like with Shama, people at Social Alternative have been surprised and pleased that you can raise a lot of money without any corporate money at all. That just from people's, for a campaign at least, political campaign for city council, you can raise a relatively decent amount of money from individuals, you know. By the way, Cornel West and Medea Benjamin just endorsed the Ginger Jensen campaign. That just came out yesterday. Cornel West and Medea Benjamin have endorsed the Ginger Jensen campaign. And the campaign has been working very hard to raise money with over 1,000 grassroots donations totaling over $60,000. And that's the most of any city council campaign that doesn't take money from big business or developers, and three times as big as Ginger's Democratic Party leaflet. Ginger's Democratic Party opponent for Minneapolis City Council in Ward 3. So in other words, the opponent is taking corporate cash. The opponent was asked if they're going to take corporate cash, and they said yes. And there's a whole paragraph in here on corporate cash is poisoning the race. And Ginger Jensen's also been endorsed by Minnesota Nurses Association and the Communication Workers of America, and organizations like Our Revolution, Twin Cities, and the Democratic Socialists of America have endorsed this campaign as well. A majority of millennials reject capitalism, and in a UCLA survey last fall, 1 in 10 incoming freshmen said they expect to participate in protests, the highest level in 50 years. And they've administered, in 50 years they've administered that survey. In Minneapolis and across the country, there's outrage against corporate politics as usual. But electing another unapologetic socialist to city council, we can demonstrate the possibility of building an entirely new fighting working class political party, working class political alternative, a new party of the 1990s. So I thought that was a really good, some news we needed to hear about the Ginger Jensen campaign. Please check that campaign out more. There's a good main article in the paper, How Can We Win Socialist Change by Brian Koulouris. Don't have time to get into it, but I'll just read a couple highlights. In July 2016, an Oxfam study showed that just 62 people owned as much wealth as half the world's population, a truly staggering figure. Now, less than 2 years later, global economic inequality has since skyrocketed to the point where only 6 billionaires own more than the poorest 3.75 billion people. The capitalist media say the economy has been in recovery for nearly a decade, yet the social conditions facing working people get worse and worse. Let's see. I just don't have time to read all that I had picked out to read from this article. Young people are angry about the future capitalism offers, dead end jobs, debt, discrimination, and environmental destruction. Bernie Sanders called for a political revolution against the billionaire class. Someone asked me. Yeah, I don't know. I'll figure that out some other time. I'm running out of time here. Yeah, youth internationalism is a part of this article. Reforms in socialism, as we started to get into before. I'll just explain a little more that as Marx, and I'm quoting, I think it's a good explanation here from Brian Kouros. Reforms in socialism, quote, as Marxists, we fight for every gain that working people can win under capitalism. This can be seen in our leadership in the fight for 15 with Social Alternative member and Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant leading Seattle to become the first major city to pass $15 minimum wage. In July of this year, we helped make Minneapolis the first Midwest city to pass 15. At this time, under the leadership of Social City Council candidate, Ginger Jensen. And in July, Sawant In July, Sawant and Seattle Social Alternative helped bring about another nationally important victory, this time passing a local measure to tax the rich to keep help fund affordable housing, education, and other vital services that was mentioned earlier. A really good article on a Marxist approach to fighting oppression, stressing a materialist outlook. Marxists are sometimes accused of not caring enough about racism and sexism and reducing everything to class or economic issues, but there's no truth to that. There's no doubt that not all socialists have treated the struggle against oppression with the seriousness it deserves, but as Marxists and Marxism in general, we see the struggle against racism and sexism as central to liberation of the working class as a whole. We believe liberating humanity from racism and sexism requires understanding the economic roots of oppression and creating a strategy for uniting the different oppressed layers of the working class in struggle to end class society and with it the material basis for the concession for the oppression. We believe that the main way consciousness charges is through common struggle. Again, that's common struggle between people that the capitalists would like to see remain separated by nationality or race or whatever. Let's see. How the bosses use racism and sexism. Sexism and racism are constantly used by the capitalist class to divide workers and hyper-exploit women and people of color. While better-paid jobs have been historically dominated by white men, racism and sexism can also effectively drive down the wages of the majority of white male workers. For example, racial divisions in the South have been a key tool used to keep unions in general, making overall wage levels there much lower than the rest of the country. In unionized workplaces where workers fight for their interests in a united way, the gender and racial gaps are a fraction of what they are in the rest of the workforce. And countries with lower gender and racial wage gaps have higher wages for all workers. A divided working class is unable to struggle effectively against those who own and control the wealth and resources of society. The labor movement and all progressive forces must fight back against each and every act of injustice and bigotry and support the struggles of all groups suffering from oppression. That was a really good article. Marxist Approach to Fighting Oppression, probably by Kaylin Nicholson, probably up on the website as well. And then running out of time, there's some quick blurbs from analysis from around the world. And wanted to get into those. They're very, very short. But remember we were mentioning Scandinavia earlier. So here's a little thing about Sweden. Sweden, outsourcing behind political crisis. Sweden is sometimes pointed to as an example of, quote, Northern European socialism, unquote. Even though it's not. I threw in the even though it's not. Continuing to quote, a recent scandal over privatizing the state transportation agency ended with the firing of two government ministers. The current Social Democratic Green Government, has embarked on a program of austerity, while the Alliance of Traditional Capitalist Parties opposed policies only because they want to go further in attacking the working class. Read about how socialists in Sweden are fighting the austerity agenda. And in the same little blurb thing, important announcement around the world and from the Committee for Workers International, the corporate media calls Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro a dictator. But what is really going on in Venezuela? This important analysis follows the election of a new constituent assembly to write a new constitution, and it comes from a socialist activist in Venezuela who opposed the agenda of the boss and were preparing the ground for a coup. They explain that the only way to defend the gains of the revolution is to decisively break with capitalism, of course, which the bureaucratic regime has opened at every stage. Yeah, there's more to talk about that maybe next time. And then finally, the paper ends up with a back page cover. Why we want you to, why we want you for socialist students? And again, if you want more information on socialist students, you can basically, sorry for the rustling here. Go to, where did that address go? I had it somewhere. I don't know. Go to socialistalternative.org is the fallback position on that. There is, there was an article, though. I had a more direct address for socialist students. Just try Googling socialist students. Make sure you get the socialist alternative part of that. And you will, that will help. Anyway, instead of looking for that little address, let me just say this is an article, back page of the new issue of Socialist Alternative. Article by Keeley Mullen, quote, we are in debt. I'm sorry, we want you for socialist students. There's a subhead, we are in debt, we are underpaid, and we see no way out. Quote, our generation was born into the dying years of the American dream. Keeley herself is just graduated from college. We are entering the adult world, trillions of dollars in debt, and we see no way out via the low-wage jobs available to us once we graduate. The unemployment rate for our generation is roughly three times that of the rest of the population, and we are earning 20% less than recent generations. Young people have entered a world racked with crisis, and we played no role in creating, which we played no role in creating. And then there's a jump to a part that talks about the fight back against this. Just a little bit from that, in order to drive Trump out of office, we need to know both what we are fighting against and what we are fighting for. We are fighting against the skyrocketing cost of education, the lack of affordable housing in major U.S. cities, and low wages that have plagued our generation. What we need to fight for includes free college for everyone in America, a $15-an-hour minimum wage, and Medicare for all. But beyond just fighting to improve life now, we are fighting against a world where the profits of the few are valued over the needs of the many, and for a world where ordinary people have democratic control over the key decisions that affect our lives. We see that a socialist world is possible. Our generation has a more favorable view of socialism than capitalism. That's the new, millennial, or whatever they're calling the newest generation. This demonstrates that our generation is through with accepting the evils of our present, of our current system, and is eager to build something new. Socialist Students is an organization of high school students, college students, and young workers who believe that the crisis created by global capitalism has reached a critical point. Six men now control the same wealth. They own the same wealth as half the global population. Our climate is in dire decay, and we are witnessing more and more frequent economic crises. We do not believe that capitalism, a system built on the rule of corporations and the wealthy, can find a way out. As with previous social systems in human history, capitalism will be replaced. We will fight for it to be replaced with socialism, a system wherein the people who make society run, who build the buildings, drive the trains, engineer new innovations, care for the sick, etc., and teach us when we are young. All these people and many more need to make the decisions. We envision a world where profit does not drive life on the planet into extinction. A world organized in the most ethical, fair, and sustainable way. Join socialist students and help us build a socialist world. So that's the back page article of the newest issue of Socialist Alternative, September 2017. Urge you to get a copy. Go to socialistalternative.org to find out more about that. And so we're pretty much out of time. 2 minutes to go. As usual, lots left over. I had a nice statement to talk about that we did for Charlottesville and the march against the fascists. Marches against fascism, including the one here in Boston where 40,000 of us, and I was there, and many socialists were there, and many members of Social Alternative were there, basically chased away 25 or 30 Nazis. By the time the day of the rally came around, they were scared, as well they should be, to show up in Boston and do that kind of stuff, do that Nazi propaganda, gain territory, gain adherence type thing. We're not going to allow that, and hopefully not allow it anywhere soon. And by the way, that's a whole discussion, how fascism is used against working people, people of color, and the socialist movement, most of all, unfortunately, historically. Anyway, so we are going to wrap it up here. Thank you very much for listening to Social Alternative Radio. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we are talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Check out our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. And say, you know, get involved. There's going to be a lot happening this fall. Trump is still in power, obviously. He's the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more going on that you can get involved with us, with others on the left. And check out that YouTube I mentioned earlier of Shama Sawant calling for a new political party along with Cornel West and others. Check out the Ginger Jensen campaign. And